The Tom Woods Show, episode 1836.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hey, everybody. Tom Woods here. We are starting Scott Horton Week today. We've done another Scott Horton Week in the past, but this time I want to promote Scott's really important, highly anticipated, long-awaited book, Enough Already, Time to End the War on Terrorism. Long-time listeners, or even short-time listeners of The Tom Woods Show, will know the name Scott Horton very well. Scott is director of the Libertarian Institute, editorial director of antiwar.com, host of Anti-War Radio on 90.7 FM KPFK in Los Angeles, and hosts The Scott Horton Show. You can check him out at scotthorton.org. He is also the author of the 2017 book, Fool's Errand, Time to End the War in Afghanistan. So we're going to be delving into this book, and the topics are going to be idiosyncratic, but there's just so darn much in here. I'm just going to pick out stuff that I think I want to hit that we haven't done as much of in the past. Because, of course, we've had Scott on quite a few times, and I want to maximize just the breadth of material that we cover here. So I'm going to focus mostly on things we've never talked about before. Scott, welcome to the show.
Hey, Tom, how are you doing?
Look, this is a great occasion. So many times I have Scott on because there's some disaster around the world or what's the U.S. up to. But now I can have you on for a hearty congratulations. You've written this fantastic book that's so important. We've all wanted it because that Scott Horton spigot of knowledge just keeps pouring out and we can't always grasp it all at once. But now we can go back and reread all we like. So great. And I know it was, you know, it's a hard project. Sometimes it's a project is hard because you know so much, not because you know so little. How do you organize it? How do you get enough of it out that people can grasp it, but not so much that they won't read it? You had a lot of quite a balancing act here, and it's very well executed. So first of all, congratulations.
Thank you very much, sir. I really appreciate it. And in fact, I could not have done it without you.
Thank you very much. That's very kind of you to say. One way or another, the universe would have gotten this book out of you, I feel. but it's very kind of you to say. My listeners, you know, of course, are huge Scott Horton fans, and they wanted to see this project come to fruition. And we even raised a little dough for you to support you during the project here. So I'm glad to be able to have you back.
Yeah, I'd like to tell that story if I could for
Please.
A second. It starts with a huge thank you to you and to all of your listeners. And this goes back, young ones, for the new listeners, this goes all the way back to summer 2019. When you had me on to hold this fundraiser and to help support, and your listeners really came through and we got matching funds and all these things. And that money not only helped me write this book, but that became the base of the entire budget of the Libertarian Institute throughout the year of 2020. I mean, I got four or five guys I've got to pay to keep the thing going. And I felt real bad. I told you this before. I got to early last summer, late last spring in 2020, and I threw the thing out and started over again because I was getting carried away on Iraq War II and it was turning into fool's errand again. And I was trying to do the balancing act like you were talking about there. So I had to start over. So there's this huge delay. It was already 6 months late. And then I added, you know, another 6 to 8 months on that after I'd promised the book to these people, you know, who had been so generous here. And so I haven't held a fundraiser for the Libertarian Institute the whole time either because I was afraid people would think I was grifting and that, oh, here you're holding a fundraiser again, but where's my book from last time, pal, and that kind of thing. So I have run my institute all the way into the ground in order to get from there to here and spent just about every last dime of that and then some. But I am proud to announce that I finally got the big shipment a couple of days ago of 400 books. So I had already sent out maybe 200 or 300. But I now have a pile of about 300 or 400 more that I was going to take them to the post office early this morning, but it's pouring down rain in Austin today. So I've had to delay that, but I've got them all packed up. Every last donor from 2019, your book is at least in a cardboard box ready to be shipped. And you will be getting yours along with my eternal thanks.
Wonderful. Well, that's great. And having had to ship many books myself in the past, I know it takes longer than just the process of packing them up and shipping them and writing the addresses on them takes three times longer than you think it will.
Yeah.
But you're doing it.
Hey, it's got to be done. And once I'm done with this, then I've got everybody on the acknowledgements page that I got to send a book to. And, you know, all of my best interviewees who I hope will write about the book somewhere, maybe that kind of thing. And then we're going to knock out this fund drive over the next couple of weeks and try to get the Libertarian Institute back on its feet. And then part of the fund drive is going to be too, that to raise money, extra money to buy massive amounts of wholesale copies of this book to give away to important and influential people as best as I can. I'm really not trying to make money off of this. I'm really just trying. Fool's errand. And this is already kind of a hit inside the libertarian movement, it seems like, judging from Twitter and the book sales and stuff, Tom. But I really want this thing to not just be for the libertarian movement and the anti-war movement, but really, really, really get it out there to the world, to the right, to the left, to every man, so that the conversation can go around that. Just this one small piece of the margin, right? You're an economist. Just move the margin a little bit where people are saying, you know, there's this new book out that says that it just doesn't have to be this way and we could just call it off now. And that you should take a look at it. Makes sense. Like if it has that role in the society for even a minute, then that's the point. I really want to get out. So I want to buy hundreds of copies wholesale and send them to all the middle ranked newspapers, send them to all the right wing AM radio hosts, send them to, I don't know, the six best congressmen, if there's six, maybe five, and their staff, and whatever creative ideas that we can do to really push the book and get it out to people is what I really want to do with this thing, and spend the rest of the spring and summer pushing it like that.
Excellent. Well, listen, we're going to take our time going through because we have all week, and I'm going to be a little idiosyncratic in the topic choices because I, first of all, have interviewed you quite a few times and we have covered some of these topics. I really want to try to cover as much new and different material as possible, even though a lot of people, I'm sure, haven't heard all the interviews with you, but I'm going to have them all linked on the show notes page on various other topics. For example, I just heard you on Thad Russell's Unregistered podcast, which I love. I love that show. I love him. Your discussion of Yemen on there was very thorough and good, and your back and forth with him was really great. So I want to do something a little bit different. I want to take the first of the rest of this episode and then the next one actually to focus on chapter one, if we might, because I don't think we've spent that much time in the past on the how we got here material, because I'm always having you on because there's some immediate disaster. But I really would like to spend some time on that. And I want to first ask you about an editorial judgment you made in the book, because if you want to ask about how does the U.S. get into all this, you could have chosen a different starting point, because you're focusing on some things that happened in the late 1970s, but you could just as easily have chosen Harry Truman's decision to recognize Israel pretty much immediately when there were still border questions and refugee matters unresolved that did alienate some of the Arab world from the U.S. I mean, you could start there. So why didn't you start there?
Well, I mean, frankly, I know less about the immediate Arab reaction to that and that history. And, you know, honestly, the book is essentially about my lifetime, right? I was in preschool when Jimmy Carter got these balls rolling. And I guess, you know, sort of, I could have started in 2003 also, right? Because even though his father, W. Bush's father, had gotten us into Iraq War I and Bill Clinton had done everything he'd done in Iraq War I and a half, still, boy, you didn't have to give that 48-hour speech and invade right there. It's such an unforced error. It's such a thing, not just in its horror, but in the reality of just how badly it did not have to happen, kind of a thing. And so I think with 1979, you have three major things going on. You have, well, and at the very beginning of 1980, you have the Iranian Revolution, you have the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan, and you have the dawn of the Iran-Iraq War. And all of these three things really play out, and the American and Israeli reaction to them play out through the 1980s and into the 1990s. And really, you know, I think those are the immediate causes. You know, I could have also gone back to like the Safari Club in the 1970s, where after the post-Nixon reforms and the CIA was banned from doing, you know, some covert things, they just outsourced it all to the Saudis. And especially throughout Africa, they did all these coups and, you know, whatever dirty work. And that was kind of the lead up to the relationship that carried forward then into Afghanistan. But at the same time, like, you got to call a halt somewhere. And if I go back to 48 and the creation of the State of Israel, then now that's, I'm biting off way more than I can chew in a book like this in terms of explaining.
Yeah, no, that's true. Yeah. And he, I don't want to ask Scott Horton why he didn't make his book longer. Yeah. Right. Because of it.
I really tried to keep it at 150. I wanted it to be like, and by the way, for the audience, you should know, Tom Woods called me one day in what, 2014 or 15 and said, let's write a book and it'll be The Terror War for Dummies. And that's what this was supposed to be. That was what Fool's Errand was supposed to be before it came a book all about Afghanistan. When I got bogged down in that, was I really wanted this to be 150 pages for your brother-in-law, not just for you, but yeah, for you to get to your people, you know, but it became 300 anyway, because I just couldn't help it, you know. And frankly, if I'm complaining that all the adults were wrong about everything my entire lifetime long, then the burden is pretty much on me to prove my case.
No, it is. It is. And when I look, frankly, when I look at the chapters of your book and I think, well, gee, which ones could we have done without? It's like asking, which of my daughters could I live without? You know, I don't want to live without any of them. So let's spend a little time. I want to talk about these different topics. Now, I had Stephen, not Pinker. He's got a similar name. He wrote a book called Overthrow.
Kinzer.
Right, because Pinker's the whatever, anthropologist, whatever. Yeah, Kinzer. I had him on. So I have done an episode on the Iran situation. So let me ask you this. 1953, the Prime Minister Mossadegh is replaced, let's say, put it kindly, with CIA help by the person known as the Shah of Iran. Mm. And it's interesting that you quote somebody from 1954, the following year, I think it's a CIA person, even using the word blowback, that we have to be prepared for the possibility of blowback when the CIA engages in operations like these. Mm-hmm. So that's interesting even to hear that word. Anyway, so
that's when it was coined. It was Dr. Donald Wilbur, a CIA historian, coined the phrase blowback in the after action report.
Which, so it was.
This is in the footnotes in Fool's Errand. You can find
it. All right, good. So what I want to ask you about, though, is it's said later on, I guess it was maybe Jimmy Carter said that was ancient history. I don't know if it was Jimmy Carter who said that in 1979 and going into 1980, when you had the Iranian Revolution and eventually the American hostages were taken. And my question is, Mossadegh, who was overthrown, was a secular guy. So why would a bunch of extreme, you know, let's say religious extremists still be bitter about that? I mean, I suppose it could be nationalistic, patriotic fervor that, yeah, he was our SOB, but he was our SOB and we'll handle him. We certainly don't want outside forces coming in. Like, what would be the connection between the overthrow of a secular guy and the rise of a religiously extreme revolution, you know, almost three decades later?
Okay, well, in fact, you know, and as I talk about in the book, and people can read about this, I think Kinzer writes about this as well, that I know Bob Dreyfus writes about this in Devil's Game, and I think Trita Parsi writes about this in Treacherous Alliance as well, that the Ayatollah Khomeini was part of a group of religious rightists who were bankrolled by the CIA in 1953 and helped to agitate from the right as pressure against Mossadegh. And, you know, the guy was slightly left-leaning. He was not pro-Soviet, but he was a little bit left nationalist and wanted to keep at least some of the money from the oil that the British were stealing. And, you know, the way I understand it, and I need to go back and read Kinzer because I read that one in like high school or 2000 or something like that. But I think I think people always overstate it that he was nationalizing the oil. I think he just wanted a percent, you know, where they were getting essentially nothing. And then the Americans pretended like, aha, see, communism. And then they were taking advantage for the Rockefellers, right? They weren't doing it for the British. They were doing it for the Americans. So they did the coup and pushed the British out of the way and turned the place into an American colony. But as you know, part of that operation was, you know, false flag attacks that they blamed on the communists, right? And then they had the right-wing religious types say, see, Mossadegh can't protect us from the communists, and all this kind of pincher strategy, you know, destabilization strategy to soften them up for the coup. And then so for 25 years, as you said, ancient history, Carter makes it sound like the coup failed back in 53 and they've been sovereign and independent this whole time, right? But no, it's just 25 years later, 26 years later, Carter saying, well, that's ancient history. But no, it's not. It's current history. They've been living under the thumb of this fascist dictator the entire time. And his security forces, the SAVAK, were trained by the Americans and the Israelis on how to torture all their dissidents to death. The thing was a brutal police state. So when he got sick and his regime started falling apart because he didn't really have any natural successors set up and that kind of thing, once he was soft enough to even approach, revolution broke out. And it was a widespread popular revolution amongst, you know, essentially all factions, apparently. And then here's the real joke. And I remember wondering this when I was a kid. I remember watching footage. I still have in my mind's eye footage of the Ayatollah Khomeini getting on a plane in Paris, France to go home. And I remember wondering, well, if this guy's so evil and the French are our best friends, why didn't the Americans just ask the French not to let him do that and just keep him in Paris? And the answer was that the CIA and the State Department told Jimmy Carter, oh, we like the Ayatollah Khomeini. He's okay. We know him from 1953 when he helped us to soften up the Shah and overthrow him. We can get along with him. It'll be fine. William Sullivan, I think his name was, compared him to Mahatma Gandhi and said, this is going to be fine. Yes, it's a regime change, but we can't stop it now. The Shah was dying of cancer. And the Americans knew that. I don't think the Iranian people knew that. But then here's really importantly, the revolution was at the very end of 78 and into the very beginning of 79. It was February 79 was when the Ayatollah actually came to power and declared the Islamic Republic. Well, Tom, it wasn't till November that the hostage crisis broke out. And the way everyone remembers this is, yeah, they did this revolution and they seized all our hostages and called us the great Satan. And that's why we have to hate them ever since and whatever. But that's not true. Jimmy Carter's government got along with the Ayatollah's new regime all through the year of 1979, passed them intelligence about threats from the Russians, passed them intelligence about threats from Saddam Hussein's Iraq, which he was just taking over in a violent coup himself. Not so much a revolution as a bloody coup d'etat there, and where they were getting along. But then David Rockefeller convinced Jimmy Carter to let the Shah into the country for cancer treatment. And once he did that, that caused a riot because it was seen as a symbol that we're going to do a coup and reinstall the guy. You know, and the last time the coup was plotted out of the U.S. embassy in Tehran. So they said, well, if that's how it's going to be, we'll seize your embassy. I'm not justifying it, but I'm saying that is what happened. So in other words, to me, that really takes two clicks away from the narrative of the implacableness of this enemy. Another major argument on that line is that the Israelis got along with Iran all along after the revolution. The Israelis didn't turn on the Iranians. It wasn't the Iranians who turned on the Israelis. The Israelis didn't turn on the Iranians until 1993. They were friends with the Ayatollah all along, sold them weapons all along. I think it's Trita Parsi in his book, Treacherous Alliance, talks about how anytime the Ayatollah was railing against the Zionist regime, that was when the Israelis were selling him the most missiles. And he was trying to pretend that he was angry at them when they had this secret alliance all the time. Remember when Ronald Reagan sold Iran missiles during Iran-Contra, he was mostly backing Saddam Hussein against them. I'm skipping ahead. But when he was backing, when he did sell missiles to Iran, it was the Israelis who were the cutouts to do it because they were already had the open channel all along. And then it was their partisans in the United States, like Michael Ledeen, who helped run the Iran-Contra affair.
Hey, folks, I want to say a quick word on behalf of maybe the most important sponsor I've ever had, and that's BetterHelp. A lot of you out there are struggling with depression, anxiety, stress, relationships, dealing with family conflicts, and you look on social media and it looks like everybody else has a perfect life and you're the outlier. Well, I'm telling you, you are not alone and help is available. BetterHelp will assess your needs and match you with your own licensed professional therapist. You connect in a safe and private online environment. It's convenient, professional, and affordable. You can start communicating in under 24 hours. This is not self-help. It's professional counseling. You get timely and thoughtful responses to messages you can send anytime. Plus, you can schedule weekly video or phone sessions. The testimonials are out of this world. And in fact, so many people have been using BetterHelp that they're recruiting additional counselors in all 50 states. I want you to start living a happier life today. As a listener, you'll get 10% off your first month by visiting betterhelp.com/woods. Join over 1 million people taking charge of their mental health. Again, that's betterhelp, HELP.com/woods. How do you connect this whole episode going from 1953 to 1979 to, you know, the American quagmire today? Is it simply that this is the origin of the bad blood between the U.S. and Iran, or is there more?
So it's like this. In 79, it starts with the Iranian Revolution, which we already covered that, the hostage crisis, then at the end of the year. In July, Sabina Brzezinski convinces Jimmy Carter, we need to start backing the Mujahideen in Afghanistan in order to lure the Soviet Union into invading Afghanistan. We'll give them their own Vietnam. And he did sign that finding. That's an order to the CIA on July 3rd, 79. Christmas 79, Russia invades Afghanistan. And he says, aha, now we can give them their own Vietnam. It'll be great. We got it in writing. It's on my website, scotthorton.org/fair use. You can find both of those documents. But then they went, oh no, if the Soviets invaded Afghanistan and Iran is kind of softened up because they got this brand new revolutionary regime, then the Soviets could invade Iran. So then Jimmy Carter announced the Carter Doctrine. You better not invade Iran, Russia, because we'll go to war with you over it. That was what the Carter Doctrine really meant. What he said was, we won't allow any other power to be the dominant power in the Persian Gulf. It's an American lake. It's under our domination, our alliance with the states of Arabia. And then that's it. And as part of that, they started building up bases in the Arabian Peninsula, in Qatar, Bahrain, and especially in Saudi Arabia. And then, of course, Jimmy Carter gave the green light to Saddam Hussein to invade Iran. And he was the new bloody coup d'etat dictator of Iraq, who had worked with the CIA on and off since 1958 and had been the former head of the secret police when they helped him round up and kill anybody with glasses, like it was, you know, Pol Pot's regime or something like that. Only they're going after the communists instead of anybody who knows better.
Yeah.
But inverse situation, same thing. Anyway, Saddam has a problem, Tom, because he is sitting on, you know, the Ba'ath Party was mixed, but it was dominated by the Sunni tribes. And he was sitting on a supermajority Shiite population. That's the same religion that's dominant in Iran, the same religion as the Ayatollah Khomeini, that sect of Islam. And so there was a challenge here, right? They're living under a minority dictatorship, foreign-supported minority dictatorship. What are the Shiite masses of southeastern Iraq going to do? Are they going to stay Iraqi nationalists, or are they going to side with their religious sect and their, you know, traditional kinship with their Persian neighbors over their national sect? And so what he did was he invaded Iran. He conscripted all those Shiites and sent them to war against Iran. And his goal was to topple the Ayatollah and nip this thing right in the bud. But it didn't work. And it led to this massive stalemate, you know, World War I type disaster, you know, trench warfare and all this stuff that lasted all through the 1990s. And so then at the end of that was when Saddam Hussein got into a dispute with Kuwait over war debts. It was his side of the war that we had supported, but so were the Saudis, the UAE, and the Kuwaitis. And he looked at it like he'd fought the whole war for them to keep Iran out of Kuwait and out of the Shiite parts of Saudi, which it happens to be where all the oil is, in what's nominally the northeast of the Arabian Peninsula, if such a thing can be said to exist, the way the whole place is tilted to the northwest. But that area right there adjacent to Kuwait is where all the Shiites live. And so Saddam thought he was being treated unfairly. And I'll make a long story short, but they essentially, I think unintentionally, Tom, but they de facto baited him into a trap and essentially told him, go ahead and invade Kuwait. We don't care. And then when Margaret Thatcher, and they really didn't care. And then when Margaret Thatcher said, oh, don't go wobbly on me now, Bush, who had already, as Bill Hicks pointed out, you know, he had already been called a wimp. It was the cover of Newsweek, the wimp president. And so once he got called out by a woman for not being man enough, he said, this will not stand. And then he spent the next 6 months pretending that Saddam wouldn't negotiate to leave Kuwait. And then once it was out that he would, he said, well, and all negotiations are rewards. And so we will not do even anything at all. They wouldn't even give him the most face-saving excuse with no substance to it. In fact, his last demand was, just promise to leave the region one day and make the Israelis promise to negotiate a Palestinian state one day. In other words, nothing. In other words, give me a piece of paper.
Everybody knows, everybody involved knows that that's nothing.
That's right. And he knew that that wasn't happening. And all he was saying was, please just give me a piece of paper with a happy face on it so I can show something to my generals so they don't kill me. And Bush wouldn't let that happen. You think we're going to build up a whole desert shield and not have a desert storm? Yeah, right. And so they launched that massive war. Hope everyone's still with me here. Most people remember most of this history. I'm just drawing a through line for you here, right? Everybody knows America backed Saddam, right?
When these events happened, I was a college freshman. I remember it vividly.
That's right. So then, and everybody remembers, if you don't remember from 1991, then you do remember the movie with Marky Mark and Ice Cube and George Clooney called Three Kings, where it's a gold heist and it takes place in the setting of the aftermath of Iraq War I, when the U.S. dominates the southern part of the country, and there's a massive Shiite uprising against Saddam Hussein that then Saddam Hussein successfully puts down. with attack helicopters and tanks that Bush Sr. and Scowcroft let him keep to do so. But the rub is that Bush had encouraged all the Shia and the Kurds too to rise up in the first place, drop leaflets over their army division saying, march on Baghdad, get them, now's your chance, and all this stuff. Bush himself said, put a message out on Voice of America saying to do it. And then they changed their mind, Tom. And the reason they changed their mind was because they realized that the Iraqi quote unquote traitors, I'm not making a value judgment, I'm just recounting the history for you here. The Iraqis who had sided with Iran when Saddam invaded Iran, remember I said there's that conflict over, are you more Shiite or more Arab and Iraqi, right? Well, some of these had said, I'm more Shiite, and they had gone and fled. Some of them also had been recruited out of the prisoner of war camps in Iran. And so now you had these Iranian-backed Iraqi Shiite militias coming across the border to take over the revolution. And Brent Scowcroft and Dick Cheney and James Baker and George H.W. Bush said, and Colin Powell, we're reversing our entire 1980s Ronald Reagan policy. Remember, H.W. Bush was Ronald Reagan's vice president. All of these men, other than Cheney, had been in the House, but all of the rest of them had all been in the Ronald Reagan administration before, Scowcroft, Baker, and Powell, and Bush Sr., of course. So they were saying, we're reversing our own policy of supporting Saddam to contain the Iranian revolution. Now we're importing it into Iraq. Don't. So they called it off and left them high and dry to be slaughtered. 100,000 people slaughtered in this great massacre, as this giant Bay of Pigs type catastrophe. Okay. But then that became the excuse to stay in Iraq. Now we have to have these no-fly zones. We're going to keep our sanctions on. This proves what a Hitlerian dictator our former employee from a few months ago, Saddam Hussein, is, and how we have to have these no-fly zones. We have to keep him under full blockade. His country under full United Nations blockade. It is against the global law for any other nation or corporations to trade with this country. Total global embargo, right? And, you know, like America's embargo against Cuba, but with a UN Security Council resolution forcing every other country to obey as well. That was the policy, okay? And then plus the no-fly zone bombings, and then the Israelis invented dual containment, which meant, well, geez, sort of kind of with our encouragement, you guys just completely smashed Saddam Hussein's army. Now, how's he supposed to contain Iran? Now, America, USA, has to stay in Saudi to contain Iraq and Iran both. And so we have this, what I call a warm war against Iraq, bombing them every once in a while in the no-fly zones, sometimes more often than every once in a while, and a cold war against Iran. What this policy meant was we can never make friends with Saddam Hussein again. Our former, essentially, you know, servant from just a few months ago, we can never let him come back in from the cold ever. He's Hitler and he's illegal, and Iraq will stay an outlaw state until he is gone. And the Iranians, the mean old Ayatollah, he died. We got a new, younger, easier Ayatollah, same one we've got now, Khamenei. And we've got Rafsanjani and Khatami and all of these so-called reformers who became president, were elected president of Iran, who just wanted to get along again. Ronald Reagan had sold them missiles within a few months after the Beirut attack of 1983. If Ronald Reagan can sell them missiles after, you know, they had supported the militia that did the Beirut attack, then in 1993, we ought to be able to get along. But the Israelis said no and vetoed that. And so then that became the policy, dual containment and keep your bases in Saudi Arabia all through the 1990s. And then, oh, see, I left out the part. I'm sorry. I skipped ahead to Iraq War II. I should have stopped and mentioned about Reagan's continuation of Carter's policy of supporting the Mujahideen in Afghanistan, because that didn't just include supporting the Afghan Mujahideen. It meant supporting the Arab Afghan army. And that meant thousands, tens of thousands of Muslim fighters from all around the world, including the United States, but especially, you know, the Arab world, who went to Afghanistan to help fight against the Soviet Union, where not only did they defend Afghanistan successfully from the Soviet Union, they saw the Soviet Union cease to exist right before their eyes, and partially correctly as the result of their efforts. The Reaganites sure thought so, no question. You go read about the Hoover Institution website, they'll tell you it was Ronald Reagan and his support for the Mujahideen in Afghanistan that helped destroy the Soviet Union. And the Mujahideen thought so too. And then these men turned on the United States when, especially Osama bin Laden and his faction, turned on the United States, because not only did they occupy the Arabian Peninsula in order to wage Iraq War I to force Saddam out of Kuwait, which Osama bin Laden had offered his men to do. There's no caves in Kuwait to hide in. I think they would have failed. But anyway, he was incensed that the white Christian American army had been invited in instead. And then that they'd broken Dick Cheney's promise that they would leave as soon as the war was over. And now they were going to stay. And so this anti-imperialist faction who had just finished being our freedom fighters, helping take down the Soviet Union, then turned on the United States. And it was the Azzam group. Bin Laden inherited the Azzam group. Nobody knows who really killed Azzam. Could have been the CIA or the Israelis, or might have been Ayman al-Zawahiri. I don't know. But anyway, whoever killed Abdullah Azzam, Osama bin Laden took over his group, merged it with Egyptian Islamic Jihad, and they attacked us all through the 1990s. They killed, they assassinated a right-wing rabbi, Kahane, in New York City in 1990. They did the first World Trade Center attack. They attacked as American Special Operations Forces training the National Guard in Saudi Arabia in 95. They blew up the Khobar Towers in 1996, which Louis Free and Bill Clinton blamed on Iran for political reasons, when it was American airmen stationed in Saudi to bomb Iraq that were exploded to death by Osama bin Laden, who was trying to make a point. And Bill Clinton instead blamed it on the Ayatollah for political reasons, which completely negated, you know, the lesson there that the American people very well could have learned if the story had been told clear that, look, we really don't belong on the Arabian Peninsula. Hell, even if we need to bomb Iraq, can't we just do that from our aircraft carriers and stuff? We really got to have bases in Saudi where we're driving these crazies crazy like this. But anyway, and then they did the embassy attacks in Africa, Dar es Salaam, Tanzania, and Nairobi, Kenya in 98. And then, of course, a failed attack on the USS, the Sullivans, and then a successful attack on the USS Cole in the year 2000. Luckily, a failed attack on LAX airport in 2000 that was busted at the Canadian border. And then September 11th. And I must hasten to add here that in the Bill Clinton years, while they were attacking us all through the 1990s, Bill Clinton was still supporting them. He supported them in Bosnia, supported them in Kosovo, and he supported them in Chechnya too. And we got it from the Stratfor documents and from great work from the former FBI lawyer, Colleen Rowley, on this. While Bill Clinton was supporting, get this, Yeltsin and Putin in their war against the Chechen terrorists, and were essentially footing the bill for the whole war, the CIA was supporting the terrorists in Chechnya against them too at the same time. And then after September 11th, Bill Clinton, Tom Lantos, and Brad Sherman, senator and a congressman, president, senator, congressman, all three said, I can't believe these Muslims would attack us like this after all we've done for them lately. And then one more point here before we wrap up this, I'm trying to go fast forward, Tom, is that they weren't just mad. It wasn't just that they were mad. They had a strategy. And the strategy was to provoke America into a big, stupid overreaction. And that doesn't mean that George Bush is so dumb that it makes him innocent. Bin Laden's bet was that he was so corrupt and cruel that he would take advantage of a crisis to expand the empire too far, to destroy America the only way America can be destroyed, overextension and imperial collapse. That's how all civilizations die. That's what that whole book, Tragedy and Hope, is about, really. There's lots of secret history in there. But if you read the introduction, the tragedy is that all empires die. But the hope is that Americans could learn from history and keep their limited republic so that their civilization doesn't die. Yeah, we didn't quite pay much attention to the positive part of Quigley's message there, Tom.
Well, listen, this is an excellent first step into your book. Remember, we want to keep the episodes at a digestible length, so because I have you all week and I don't want to exhaust you. He says jokingly to the audience, like it's possible to exhaust Scott Horton, but
no problem.
If it is going to happen, I don't want it to occur on the Tom Woods Show. So we're gonna pick up next time from some of the places where, now that we have some historical background, we'll get into what people recognize as the beginnings of the war on terror, and I certainly have plenty of questions to ask you. So the book is Enough Already, Time to End the War on Terrorism, and I'm linking to it at tomwoods.com/1836. Scott, we'll see you tomorrow. All right, everybody, before we wrap up, I want to give you some nice news about our friend Pete Kanonas, who's been a guest on the show a number of times, and we talked most recently about his documentary that many of you watched called The Monopoly on Violence. And it was a documentary on the state and anarchism and private property and stuff like that. And it was crowdfunded and produced completely by libertarians. It features dozens of leading libertarian theorists and activists. I was in there myself. It's available on Blu-ray, digital download. So some of you have seen it, streaming free on Amazon Prime, seen by hundreds of new people daily. Well, they've got a follow-up documentary. They're going to be working on another project, and I know it's one you're going to want to be on board for. And it's called America's Police Crisis. So it's the same creative team that brought you the Monopoly on Violence with some new additions. And the point of it is to look at the history of police in America, the problems right now, and how the system can be changed. They've got a bigger budget this time. The subject matter has a broader appeal, I think. They're already 40% funded in their second week, he tells me. And the crowdfund, if you'd like to be part of this, you get nice benefits for helping out and being part of this, can be found at americaspolicecrisis.com. So check that out, americaspolicecrisis.com. You know Pete puts out a good documentary. You know this one will be excellent. This is a way of reserving your copy early and also helping out the project. So americaspolicecrisis.com. I'm going to link to it at tomwoods.com/1836. Now, Pete actually used my link to get his hosting. And so he's actually cashing in on the free publicity that he's allowed to get. Now, poor sucker, I would have done it for him for free because he's a friend. But okay, he went through the proper channels. So if you would like to get some nice publicity for a website that you're thinking of starting, before you start that website, check out tomwoods.com/publicity and you'll see how to get all my goodies, my bonuses, the publicity here on the show, membership in my private bloggers group, free video tutorials that'll help you get up and running really quickly. Make sure you get all these free bonuses. They don't cost you a cent. All you have to do is when you go to get your web hosting, which you have to get anyway, just use my link to get it. You get all these free bonuses. So get the details on all this at tomwoods.com/publicity. And Scott Horton Week continues tomorrow.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.